Welcome to the podcast of the City Club of Eugene, Oregon. The City Club builds community vision through open inquiry and is dedicated to enabling an informed public on a wide range of topics. Coming up in today's program.
The ongoing conflict caused by Russia's invasion of Ukraine is of central international concern. The consequences of that war have already been felt around the globe, and the bravery of the Ukrainian people is an inspiration for us all. What is the history of the relations between Russia and Ukraine leading up to this conflict, and what does Russia hope to achieve?
We appreciate the sponsors who make our civic work possible, including Kaiser Permanente, kp.org, Lane Community College, lanecc.edu, Peace Health, peacehealth.org, the University of Oregon, uoregon.edu, and generous support from Lane County and the City of Eugene. And here's today's program.
Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's June 17th, 2022 program, The War in Ukraine, Causes and Effects. And my name is Karin Knutson, and I'm City Club's president. In today's program, looking at the causes and effects of the war in Ukraine, we are delighted to be joined by Julie Hessler, PhD and Associate Professor of History at the University of Oregon, Keith Eddins, retired diplomat and adjunct professor at the University of Oregon, and Christoph Ross, PhD and visiting professor at the University of Oregon. More biographical information about today's speakers is available on our website, cityclubofeugene.org. The ongoing conflict caused by Russia's invasion of Ukraine is of central international concern. The consequences of that war have already been felt around the globe, and the bravery of the Ukrainian people is an inspiration for us all. What is the history of the relations between Russia and Ukraine leading up to this conflict, and what does Russia hope to achieve? Experts on the history and cultures of this region will address these questions and describe the roles that Europe, the United States, and NATO play in helping Ukraine today. The fate of the Ukrainian refugees in Europe and elsewhere will also be discussed. Today's speakers have extensive experience in dealing with Russian and Eastern European countries and migration patterns around the globe. And it is now my pleasure to welcome Professor Julie Hessler to the podium.
So I've got 10 minutes to talk about the Russian side of this conflict. And there are a lot of different ways that I can that you could approach this. I thought I would focus really on Putin's worldview and the way that Ukraine fits into that worldview. And this is a worldview not just distinctive to him, but widely shared by Russian nationalists, a major part of the political spectrum in Russia. So I have four themes that I'm going to try to just touch on very briefly. The first theme is Soviet nostalgia. The second, the idea of a Russian world in which Russians and Ukrainians are part of one nation. The idea that Ukraine is a failed state. And finally, the idea that Ukraine has been a pawn of the West. So those are my four things that I'm going to try to touch on really briefly. So with regard to Soviet nostalgia, Putin has gone on the record many, many times saying things along the lines of the collapse of the USSR was one of the great geopolitical catastrophes of the 20th century. He's called it a humanitarian tragedy. And I think that this, to some extent, comes as a surprise to Americans, because Americans were generally used to thinking of the Soviet Union as a repressive dictatorship that stifled intellectual life and religious freedoms, that stymied economic development with its bureaucratization and over-centralization. And so I think for Americans, it's like, what's there to miss about the USSR? Putin has a qualified answer to that. He sees, and again, Russian nationalists much more generally share this, they see some major positives in the Soviet experience. One of those positives was the strong state. A strong state, from this perspective, was able to maintain order domestically across 11 time zones. It ensured that the country's interests would also be taken into account in the international arena. Ideologically, They also appreciated some things about the Soviet Union. In the United States, when we thought about the Cold War, and we tended to think of the United States as the free world, the center of the free, so-called free world, and so we emphasized freedom as a core value of the US that the Russians did not share. On the Soviet side, though, there were also values that they appreciated. They thought of themselves as anti-imperialist and anti-racist. They thought of themselves as uniquely altruistic in the international arena, as against what they perceived as America's tendency to use the language of freedom as a cover-up for supporting American interests abroad. But Putin also sees one major negative in the Soviet legacy that I think is connected to that anti-imperial idea, and that is that the Soviet Union, in its efforts to be something other than an imperial power, made great efforts back in the time after the Russian Revolution of 1917 to set up a non-imperial state structure, one that created republics based on the many nationalities, at least the larger ones, that inhabited that large Soviet state. Their effort was to promote multi-ethnic harmony by strengthening non-Russian languages, cultures, and political identities at the expense of Russian ones. Now, there are different ways you can treat this, but there is a kernel of truth to this depiction. Scholars have pointed both to the way that the Soviet Union acted as a breaker of nations, I think the picture that we've more commonly seen in the United States, but also the ways that the Soviet Union acted as a maker of nations. And so Putin really is putting the emphasis on the maker of nation. The Soviet Union made nations, often artificially, that might not have existed. So that brings me to my second theme, one nation. The idea is that Ukrainians, Belarusians, and Russians, at the very least, share a culture, a history. Many have the same religion of orthodoxy. In many cases, there are shared languages. Many, many Ukrainians speak Russian as their native language. That's also true in Belarus. There's intermarriage. Many Russians and Ukrainians live on both sides of the border, and that's also true with Belarus. The Russian nationalists imagine Russia's history with Ukraine not as a colonial or imperial history, but rather as one created by a free union of the Ukrainian people, just a branch of the Russians in this view, and the Russian people, dating back to 1654. Again, there's a lot to dispute about this perspective. I'm not describing this as my own view, but as a Russian nationalist view. But from this perspective, the Soviet Union artificially strengthened a separate Ukrainian identity with its national policies and its creation, for the first time in history, of a distinct Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. And I think that there's an emotional side to this idea about making nations, making Ukraine, with respect to Ukraine, that is not felt on the part of Russian nationalists when they think about the non-Slavic parts of the former Soviet Union, Georgia or Armenia or the Central Asian republics. So my third theme is that Ukraine has been a failed state taking on the viewpoint of a Russian nationalist. It is certainly the case that Ukraine went through a particularly difficult transition period after the collapse of communism. All of the post-Soviet states struggled economically in the 1990s, but Ukraine's struggle went very deep and it lasted very long. I think we can see that in the fact that, before the Russian invasion this year, Ukraine was Europe's poorest country, poorer than North Macedonia, poorer than tiny landlocked Moldova, poorer than Bosnia-Herzegovina. So it's a very poor country. Despite the fact that Ukraine has an abundance of natural resources, it's got some of the world's richest farmland. So this is a kind of a sorry economic performance, and it's one that Putin and Russian nationalists blame the Ukrainian government for bringing Ukraine to this point, to this place. Ukraine suffered from corruption, again, not uniquely among post-Soviet countries, but it has had a particularly bad record of corruption. And then from a Russian nationalist perspective, Ukraine has had two revolutions in the 2000s, one in 2004, one in 2014. Both were centered on Kyiv, the capital city, both pitted anti-Russianists, like, that's not quite the right word, but both pitted those who saw their future as oriented towards Western Europe, the EU, and NATO institutions, and those who saw in their future a continuing relationship, strong relationship with Russia, and frankly, dependency on Russia. So in each case, the revolution's result was to overturn an elected government, granted in the first case elected with a lot of irregularities, and to pivot Ukraine towards the West and away from Russia, and it was very much seen as a zero-sum game by Russians. Russians have a complex view of these events, but that centers on the way that foreign influences, now here's my fourth theme, pawn of the West, foreign influences came in and supported those protesters who overturned elections in favor of the West and in an anti-Russia way. But they also see those events as growing out of the failure and weakness of the Ukrainian state. By contrast, the Russian state has been, up until now, stable and prosperous in the Putin era. So the very long Putin era, just as a reminder, he has effectively been in power since 1999, with a brief period when he switched places with his prime minister for 4 years. So I guess, again, just the end point of this is that events that have happened in Ukraine since the collapse of the USSR have strengthened a Russian nationalist perspective in Russia that Ukraine is weak and divided. It's weak because of its weakness of its state. It's also fallen out of its natural position as part of the so-called Russian world, when it really is one nation with the Russians. And it's done so because of malign outside influences from the West. And that's all. I'm going to turn this over to Keith Edens next.
Thank you, Julie, very much. So like Julie, I'm trying to do a lot in 10 minutes. And I'm going to touch on 5 points, but I'm going to try to do the first four pretty darn quickly and spend most of my time on the final one. The 5 points are Russian interest and goals. The second one's NATO's interest and goals. Third one, Russian actions. Fourth one, NATO actions. And fifth one, what's next? And I want to say right off the bat that I'm speaking primarily about Russia and NATO here, but I am not trying to deny Ukraine its sovereignty or its agency. Not at all. And it's obviously a key element of what's going on in Central and Eastern Europe right now. But in developing this panel, those are my areas of experience and expertise, and that's what I want to spend some time on. In terms of Russian interest and goals, I think Julie does a good, very good job, as always, of providing the perspective, if you will, of an academic looking at what a Russian nationalist, as she described it, how they would describe some of these issues. I'm looking at it a little more as a diplomat from the outside, and I would start off by saying that Russian interest, just like every state has a key interest, is in providing security for itself and its people. security in the form of non-threatening neighbors, in the form of safety from invasion or attack. But of course, Ukraine presented no threat of invasion or attack against Russia, against the Russian Federation. Rather, Putin and the Russian government saw Ukraine as a political threat in the sense that Ukraine represented a model of a large post-Soviet Slavic state that was developing, albeit slowly and, you know, not perfectly, a Western-style democracy, an EU-style functional economy. And as such, Ukraine represented competition, a competitive threat to Putin's authoritarian model. And I would argue that Putin's immediate goal, which he was very clear about, was to remove contemporary Ukraine from the political equation in political economic terms. And his longer term objective, as Julie hinted at, or maybe said directly, was restoring something akin to the old Russian Empire or some version of a Slavic Soviet Union. A secondary goal was to weaken NATO and the EU, but I'm not going to get into that in any detail. In terms of NATO's interest and goals, I want to start off by being clear. NATO, just like the European Union, is an institution composed of independent member states. NATO does not act independently. It's not a unitary actor, if you will, since its actions and decisions reflect the will of its members. But for our purposes, I'm going to be talking about NATO as if it were a unitary actor. So in terms of interest, and that's the key point here, NATO's interest is the security of its member states. NATO's interest is in deterring an attack on any member state via its pledge of collective security. And support for Ukraine in the context of this war, in the context pre-war, and in the context post-war, is all about extending NATO's commitment to protect its own member states to Ukraine, not because Ukraine is a member, but because a Russian victory would threaten the security of NATO members. In effect, providing support to Ukraine, whether it be weapons or intelligence, is extending NATO's perimeter, extending its security perimeter, and in doing so, protecting countries like Poland, Slovakia, the Baltic states, and the other NATO members in Central and Eastern Europe. An evolving objective, however, of NATO has been, as we've seen, a weakened Russia, because quite frankly, NATO's security will be enhanced if in the long term, Russia emerges weaker from this war than when it started. Third point, in terms of Russian actions, no one should be surprised by the Russian army's actions, activities, either on or off the battlefield. The Russian Army's actions, behavior has been consistent with the Red Army's behavior during World War II, with the Russian Army's behavior in both the First and the Second Chechen Wars, and the Russian Army's and Air Force's actions in Syria. On the battlefield, we've seen indiscriminate use of artillery and missiles without regard for civilian casualties. Off the battlefield, we've seen atrocities against both individuals and groups of people. Russia has engaged in crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing, not to mention the crime of aggression. And again, I'm not an international lawyer. From a big picture standpoint, this is Russia's style of warfare. From a smaller picture standpoint, you're seeing a lack of discipline, which comes from a not having a professional core of non-commissioned officers and not having an approach to the battlefield, a battlefield approach that looks at conduct and behavior as critical elements. Fourth point, NATO's actions. I won't spend much time here. We've seen NATO pushing weapons, pushing training, pushing intelligence to the Ukrainians. NATO has been held back by a desire to avoid appearing to support offensive operations against Russia proper. But NATO has also seen its political unity increase, and I think we'll see this when NATO meets in Madrid in a couple of weeks for its latest summit, where we are likely to see Sweden and Finland approved for membership, or at least pushed forward closer to membership. The leaders of Japan, Australia, and South Korea are going to attend that NATO summit, which speaks to the situation in Ukraine. And you're going to see support for a new NATO strategic concept. You will not see Ukraine be offered NATO membership. You will not see Ukraine even be offered what's called a membership action plan, which is kind of sort of akin to what the European Union just decided to do in offering Ukraine candidate status. Now, final points. What comes next? A few days ago, a senior British military official said Russia had already, quote, strategically lost, unquote, the war in Ukraine because they will not achieve their key objectives, because NATO will emerge stronger, because Russia will be diminished. That does not mean that Russia won't achieve some tactical achievements, as demonstrated in Georgia, South Ossetia, in Moldova, Transnistria, in Ukraine earlier in this decade or last decade with Crimea. Russia has and will accept so-called frozen conflicts that can then be thawed out in the future, which is why the Estonian prime minister has made some very eloquent arguments about the need to ensure that any settlement will demonstrate that Russia has actually lost the war and that it cannot renew the war at some point. I'm running out of time here, so I'm going to close with this. You can look at the notion of some sort of settlement of the war as being very difficult for either side to accept, a political settlement of the war. I am not optimistic that this war is going to end anytime soon. I think what we're looking at is months, if not years, as the two sides try to determine what either side can accept. And I think we're all going to emerge disappointed from a moral perspective, from an outside perspective. But the key point is, it has to be a Ukrainian decision. This cannot be a decision, as they said about Munich in the Czech Republic, in Czechoslovakia, o nas bez nas, about us, without us. It has to be a decision that Ukraine makes, and I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Hello. Thank you, Eugene City Club, for your kind invitation and the opportunity to participate in this event. My brief talk will spotlight how Western Europe and Germany are dealing with the war that Russia is waging against Ukraine, a brutal and utterly unjustified invasion of a peaceful and sovereign nation in direct neighborhood to the European Union. To begin with, since I'm not just speaking to you as a historian, but also as a citizen of Europe and a citizen of Germany, allow me to disclose my own position as a speaker. I'm a historian, a professor from Germany, holding a chair in modern history and historical migration studies. The two fields I mostly work in are the history of migration, especially forced displacement in the aftermath of the Second World War, and the evolution of a global refugee regime on the one hand, and on the other hand, I researched the Holocaust, the German war of annihilation in Eastern Europe, and organized violence under Nazi rule. My research groups actually engage in several projects with partners in Belarus and in Ukraine focused on sites of mass killing. And in fact, we were scheduled to spend this coming September in Berdichev, Ukraine, to conduct non-invasive surveys of graves from the Shoah. Both our own history with Ukraine and how refugees are received in Europe are relevant, I think, to understanding the current situation. Our work with partners in Central and Eastern European countries became possible during the past decades. Ukraine today is a part of the international academic community. A dense network of cooperation and joint work has grown between Ukraine and many countries. Very recently, we could not imagine at all that this could be threatened. But war in Europe became a reality again, and the disruptions are severe. Now we try to keep up connectedness. We keep it alive in ways that work under the unspeakable situation that the Russian invasion is creating. Some of our colleagues were turned into refugees, some into soldiers, and many try to hold out and protect the historical sites in their custody, even under bombardment. How did we get here? From a European perspective, things seem to go well with our immediate eastern neighbors for the past 30 years. On the political level, NATO was expanding, which was a good thing. We all know that this military alliance has purely defensive purposes. On the economic level, the EU prospered and grew. We began talks with Ukraine to join, not in the foreseeable future, but eventually. Bulgaria, Romania, Poland, and Hungary, together with other Central European countries, demonstrated that the eastward expansion was a challenge, but it could work. Even with Belarus, often and rightfully called the last dictatorship of Europe, things seemed to improve until the brutal suppression of the democratic opposition there since 2020. Apart from high politics, we all could feel the change. Ukrainian trucks began to haul goods across the European Union. People's mobility increased, and our ties grew thicker. We also experienced that in research. Students come over, contacts intensify, and joint work became much more regular, normal. We imagined that going to France or going to Ukraine would not make much of a difference in the near future. But we failed to see that Russia experienced what was happening in vastly different and distorted ways. Each step taken by Ukraine towards the West was perceived as a threat. Europe, the idea of Europe, grew into an unwelcome, since politically and economically attractive, alternative affiliation for societies in Central and Eastern Europe. That became a problem from a Russian point of view. Not everyone appreciates democracy, peace, and prosperity as good things. Eventually, we failed to step up when Russia challenged the newly gained freedoms when Putin invaded and annexed the Crimean Peninsula and occupied eastern Ukraine. How did that happen? Of course, it will always be a tough decision to sever relations or to even go to war over a piece of land far away, at least from a contemporary European perspective. We learned lessons from history. Moreover, and importantly, Germany and other countries in Europe have indeed driven themselves into a fatal dependency on Russian resources. It was tempting to accept those deals, gain access to cheap energy supplies, and do good business with Moscow, its oligarchs, and its monopolies. At the same time, however, Germany believed it was following a good plan, another lesson learned from the past. Remember, Germany and France fought wars over territory and continental hegemony for centuries. Had you asked a German or a Frenchman in 1875 if there would ever be a lasting peace, the answer would surely have been no. Nein, jamais. One path to peace after the Second World War was doing business together. That was, by the way, also a key idea of the Marshall Plan. From the 1950s on, the French and the German economy became so deeply entangled that none of the two could afford another war. We became partners and friends, allies even. It took a while, and it was not easy. And, by the way, it was us, the Germans, who started as an outlaw after 1945. That experience became part of our rationale for dealing with Russia post-1991. But there was a difference. We were dealing with an authoritarian pseudo-democracy unable to overcome its grievances from losing the Soviet Empire. While we thought we were doing business diplomacy, the other side set the stage for the next round. Commemorating the end of the Second World War in Europe the defeat of Nazi Germany and the liberation of my country by the Allies on May 8th. In this year, our president, Walter Steinmeier, spoke of an Epochenbruch, the end of an era. Chancellor Olaf Scholz, in recent speeches, prepared us for a turning point, a Zeitenwende. And indeed, we brace for an energy crisis, prepare to rearm, support Ukraine with funds, goods, and military equipment, and face the threat of being dragged into the conflict as a warring party. We live through the liminal moment of realizing that the old normal is gone. This transition includes facing the consequences of standing up against Russia, Russian aggression. A stark choice for Germany. We adopted pacifism after 1945 in the face of Germany's unspeakable crimes. But how can we now stand aside in the face of Ukraine's suffering? Kiev is about 1,200 kilometers east of Berlin. That's roughly the distance from Eugene to LA. Krakow in Poland is about 300 kilometers away from Lvov in Ukraine. That equals a drive from here to Seattle. To us, the war in Ukraine is far away, and it is very near at the same time. The westward movement of Ukrainian refugees makes this very clear every day. About 7.5 million people have left the country due to the war since February of 2022. Another 7 million people face displacement inside Ukraine. That is a third of the population, and it amounts to the most traumatic forced migration crisis in Europe since the Second World War. Recent experiences with refugees due to war and violence are not new to us. Since 2015, more than 1 million refugees from Syria and several hundred thousand from Afghanistan and other places have arrived in Germany alone. That triggered an unprecedented wave of help and solidarity, but also a deep division of our society, resulting, for instance, in a new racist and xenophobic political party getting 10% of the seats in our parliament. Now, in a matter of weeks, millions of Ukrainians have found refuge in Poland and other countries bordering Ukraine. More than 600,000 refugees from Ukraine have arrived in Germany. This translates into 70,000 Ukrainians which currently live in Berlin alone. My hometown, Osnabrück, roughly the size of Eugene, harbors several thousand newly arrived Ukrainians, like most cities this size back home. Are we up to this? We might. For once, the European Union evoked the Temporary Protection Directive, which was adopted in 2001 as a consequence of the Balkan Wars of the 1990s, but had never been activated before. It provides mechanisms to react to sudden and large-scale forced displacement of people into European Union territory. This directive offers war refugees immediate and unconditional access to temporary protection, the social security systems, education, housing, and the labor market. And indeed, societies in Europe quickly opened their borders to Ukrainians. That was quite a contrast to what happened during the Syrian refugee crisis, when many European countries tried to shield themselves from providing asylum, often in quite shameful ways. And it is quite a contrast to the handling of the refugee crisis at the EU southern border in the Mediterranean, or the recent refoulement of refugees from the Middle East who tried to cross into Poland via Belarus. The solidarity with Ukraine and the unprecedented protection of refugees are encouraging for the time being and much needed relief. But it is not what we're experiencing now, even the beginning of an end to this crisis. We must keep help and solidarity up in the face of mounting pressure and difficulties. We must accept that massive migration from Ukraine will change Europe profoundly. This will not go away in a couple of weeks or even years, and the political consequences are unforeseeable. Gas energy prices for households are about to double in Germany, and many people will not know how to pay these bills. Letters announcing this arrived yesterday back at homes in Osnabrück. But as always, a crisis is also a change to grow, a chance to grow, and to show who we really are. The invasion is first and foremost a tragedy for Ukraine, and then also a test for our own humanity, a test we better pass. From a European perspective, one thing is obvious. The three decades during which we tried to lure ourselves into the predicted end of history are over. The peaceful and prosperous expansion of the Western European model has met brute force, trying to prevent free, sovereign, and democratic societies from deciding about their future. Ukraine is paying the price. We seem to have three choices now, as Hafried Münkler, a leading political scientist in Germany, recently argued. We tried to buy Russia out of its revisionism. That failed. We are now tempted to fall for appeasement and allow a Russian victory while selling out Ukraine for an illusion of peace. That will be a moral, a humanitarian, and a political disaster. We might have to prepare ourselves for fencing off Russian aggression through deterrence for quite a while. What a gruesome choice. Once more, freedom will not be free in Europe. Thank you.
If you enjoyed this presentation by the City Club of Eugene, please visit our website at cityclubofeugene.org or our YouTube channel and our social media pages.